A sound of dripping water, faint, came and went with fool's breathing. His heart was laboring. He set his hands on his knees and doubled over, the handkerchief at his lips. "We should keep going," the big detective said. "We should finish this and be gone." Fool straightened, studied the man. "What is it?"
"Nothing."
Pinkerton nodded, walked a few feet farther, the corona of light receding on the walls and the low ceiling overhead. "I keep asking myself, why?" Fool called softly to the detective's back. "Why did she jump? What was she so frightened of?" Pinkerton was standing peering up the tunnel, and he turned now and lifted the lantern and regarded Fool with his black eyes glinting. "It wasn't the jump that killed Charlotte Reckitt," he said. "I don't know what this Saracen of yours is capable of, but whatever she met with that night was a damn sight worse than a broken neck." Fool blinked sharply. "Forgive me," said Pinkerton. A moment passed, another, and then, as if by unspoken assent, Fool rose and they went wordlessly on. The air worsened. Fool was thinking of Charlotte in the freezing Thames, and the water closing over her face, and her hair adrift, and then he bit hard down on his lip. He cleared his head. He watched the flame in the lantern shrink, but it did not go out. At each turn, Pinkerton stopped and double-checked the map and marked an arrow in chalk on the wall. They passed under what must have been the public privies, the wood floor rotting above them, and turned left down a narrow passage splashing through a puddle of clean water, and came at last to a set of glistening stairs leading upward. Fool could just make out a faint glow of light ahead. "This is the place," Pinkerton whispered. "Come." It was a long, wide, dry chamber with alcoves in the facing walls, enshrouded by darkness, and a few solitary stubs of candles burning down at the feet of huddled occupants. A puddle oozed near the door, and Fool saw the shriveled hams of a man squatting over it, and he looked away. There was a cough from some place deep within, and then a second answering cough, and then the silence of many figures observing. Pinkerton walked slowly the length of the arches, holding the lantern aloft at the beggars and mudlarks hunched in their robes, wattled arms clutching their rags to ward off the light. In the far corner, Fool found the woman Mrs. Sharper had described, an ancient crone swaddled in rags, her huge grey feet bare and outsized with the crusted mud of the river. Livid scars stretched from the corners of her mouth up her cheeks, like some grinning cruelty made flesh, her throat corded with the strain of twisting her face from the light. It was a stone alcove, shallow and level with the floor, and at one time must have opened onto a drainage line, but had since been bricked over and sealed, and she had laid out her scavenged goods and filthy straw to make her bed. Her gums moved, chewing at a long strand of grey hair. Her hands were liver-spotted and trembling. Fool crouched. Pinkerton set the lantern down beside him on the slick stone. "Are you the one they call Muck Annie?" Fool asked. She spat out the knot of hair, scowled up. "Muck Annie," he said again. "Is that you?" Her face dipped, and greasy tendrils of hair obscured her eyes, her nose. Sharp, broken teeth, brown in the weak light, great gaps between. Her mouth was open slightly. Her lips were wet.
"We're looking for someone," Fool said.
"A man that used to sleep here."
"What's hay?"
she demanded suspiciously. She was glaring at Pinkerton, her voice creaking as if from long disuse.
"We can pay you," said Fool.
At this she grinned a weird, lascivious grin, and the scars twisted, and she glanced furtively from side to side, and then picked at the front of her dress and leaned forward. She extended a wizened claw.
"Go on, you," she said. "Give it here, then."
Fool heard something stir in the blackness beyond. He glanced at Pinkerton, but the big man did not seem alarmed. He was studying Muck Annie with a dead expression.
"We're looking for a man you once knew," he said. "Jonathan Cooper."
She did not react. The rustling of her rags was like a thing uncoiling from a nest. He glanced at Pinkerton, then back at the woman.
"Jonathan Cooper," he said again. "Do you know him or not?"
She licked at her lips.
"Aye," she said. "I knows him. Ewart took me leavings off to the Lascar and never come back. I got something of his own here, I do.
The Lascar, Pinkerton murmured. What's the Lascar?
You mean the opium dealer, Fool said. In Wapping.
But she had twisted in her rags to fumble about behind her, and then she turned back with a battered tin kettle with the top missing and held it on its wire stem towards them.
Go on, she said. Pity a poor maid. Go on, sirs.
How do we find Jonathan Cooper, Annie?
Fool said. She gave them a sly look.
You never do.
Is he dead?
She shook her head. Fool withdrew a shilling from his pocket and held it gleaming before her, and all at once she froze, as if transfixed by the coin.
Annie,
he said.
You never find him.
She whispered fiercely,
he finds you.
19. William awoke in a fever, with his hair hot and plastered to his neck, and the sheet sticking to his spine, and he shuddered and slept again, and when he awoke next the windows were dark, and he had kicked clear of his blankets. He stumbled to the dresser and poured a glass of water from a pitcher there, and the silver arc of it was like mercury in the faint light, and left him light-headed and cold. He fumbled his way back to bed, slept, woke, slept again, shivering through it as if sick with some bacillus of grief, bred of the ditches and the drains. A spill of lantern on slimed walls, the half-crazed leer of Muck Annie. Then came a grey light filtering in through the windows, and he opened his eyes and sat up in a tangle of blankets feeling weak, with his head aching, but with his thoughts, thank God, clearing. He did not know what day it was. He rose and staggered towards his wardrobe and began shakily to dress. No, he could not eat. Only twist his spoon in the light of the sitting-room windows and watch a blade of light flicker across the ceiling and down the wall's mouldings. He set it with a click down on his plate and ran a handkerchief over the back of his neck, and it came away damp. He felt the floor tilt. Stood again and waited with both hands grasping the edge of the table. When he went at last out, he was careful to lock his door and pocket the key, and he walked deliberately out of the elevator and through the lobby, greeting no one. At Scotland Yard neither Blackwell nor Shaw was in. The desk sergeant scanned his ledger with his crooked knuckles, then gave William a street address in Drury Lane for the inspector.
"Phew, that can't be right,"
the sergeant muttered. He flipped back 2 pages and was quiet, then looked up with a shrug of his battered old shoulders. He said that he was certain the chief would be at his club. Did William know the way and all right? Then he frowned at William's pallor and said,
"You might want to sit a minute, sir, if you don't mind my saying."
He minded. There were smudged lanterns screwed to the outer walls of the hansom he flagged down, and they rattled as the cab swayed and started off. The driver's whip came lazily down from above, and the beast took no notice but went on at her same steady, weary pace, and William sat back huddled in the nook, feeling the cold wind on his face, and he squinched his eyes shut. The driver shook him angrily awake.
"Right now, out!"
He did not protest. His heart was beating fast, and he climbed down from the hansom and peered up at the grim facade of Shaw's Club, and heard through the blood in his temples a low whistle, and when he turned he saw the driver leaning down to him, holding out a cupped hand. The man wore knitted gloves with the fingers cut away, and his nails were black with dirt. He found Shaw seated in a high-ceilinged dining room among mostly empty tables, his back to the window. He was eating with 2 forks, and William glanced at the bloody cut, swimming in its juices, and felt his stomach churn.
"Mr. Blunt," he said, "desk sergeant said I'd find you here."
"What? Eating?"
Shaw grunted. He patted his pale green waistcoat. "Should I be offended?" Chewing and chewing as he spoke, his cheeks packed. He reached for his wine and took a drink and swallowed, and then said, "Didn't I instruct you to get some rest? This is me resting. I almost believe it."
Shaw was pulling apart the soft meat on his plate.
"Sit. We've started teams of 2 covering pubs in the city," he said.
showing the good doctor's drawing of the woman.
It could take a while. I've put Mr. Blackwell in charge. If I've learned nothing else in 20 years, I've learned patience.
What? What's the look?
What look?
Like you're eyeing up the tastiest bits to bite into.
Of that?
Of me? William's head was thick still, and it seemed his skull trailed slowly behind him. He took out his pipe and a pinch of tobacco and stuffed its bowl with trembling hands.
There's no look, John, he said. I'm just tired. Is there anything I can do? You're the great detective. You tell me.
William looked at him.
What? Is there a problem between us, John?
Shaw sighed.
Ah, it's not you. Jesus. I've my bloody hands full. This Fenian mess. A review scheduled next month. A half dozen crimes with no suspects and a half dozen suspects with no crimes. Mr. Blackwell's canvassing his streets without a partner, and all I can do is pray he doesn't slip up. What I want is this to do with Charlotte Reckitt wrapped up, and I can't say I care too much how it ends, so long as it ends.
But you want evidence.
Well, evidence is always preferable.
Shaw regarded him now with a clear, expressionless gaze.
You look terrible, William. You should get yourself back to your rooms. Lie down.
William's shirt felt damp. It was sticking to his ribs. He wiped at his face.
I went into the sewer lines, he said in a low voice, into the overflow line south of Blackfriars. On a tip. I went looking for Jonathan Cooper.
Shaw took a long, slow sip of his wine.
I thought you might do something foolish. I didn't find him. You're lucky you came back out.
William dabbed at his hot temples.
I came back out with a name, he said. The Lascar, an opium dealer. Does that mean anything to you?
Not in relation to Charlotte Reckitt. William waited. Shaw worked at his teeth with his tongue. At last, he said,
Lascar Sal is who you mean. Operates down out of Wapping. Wretched area, that. Bloody Chinese box of a place to find, I'm told.
He cast a quick glance at the hushed tables nearby and muttered, We let the house operate because it keeps the worst off the streets. It's an arrangement. Not perfect, I know, but... He paused, studied William.
I don't know what you're up to, William, but I find it hard to accept as agency business.
Well, when did we meet?
72.
When I first sat down with your father, I realized the Yard wasn't even modern in its methods. You know, I worked with him for years. There was never this sort of nonsense.
What sort would that be?
Skulking about the sewers, running grifters off bridges into the Thames.
William smiled tightly. My father had his ways, too.
I have some idea what agency business looks like, William. It doesn't look like this. It's mostly background checks and paperwork. The Charlotte Reckitt business you've been on about. There's no client involved, is there? Since when did the agency start hunting the Flash on its own?
William met the man's stare. You just be careful, Shaw said grimly. I'm telling you that now. I've had some comments from the higher-ups, wondering about you being here. You know I'm glad to do what I can for you, and I'll leave you to your inquiries. But keep it legal. Or if not legal, at least out of the papers.
William rubbed at his forehead.
I'll do my best.
Shaw started to eat again. Scrape and click of cutlery. How did it go with Martin Reckitt? He asked casually. A slight glance up as he asked it.
William shrugged. I gather there's no love lost between the two of you.
Mr. Blackwell informed me that he was not present for much of the interview.
That was my fault. Reckitt wouldn't talk with him there.
Well, anything of interest? The blood was pressing at the back of William's eyes. He blinked hard.
He said the two of you grew up together. He said you'd taken an interest in him.
Shaw paused in his chewing, studied William tiredly. Swallowed.
Thing about a gifted liar is, there's always just enough truth to make the lies dangerous. Some of Reckitt's stories are genuine red-letter jobs.
I know it.
Martin Reckitt's a liar who nearly cost me my job. That's the only truth.
William looked at Shaw, wondering where that truth left off and the lie began. He knew there would be more to it, and he thought of Blackwell's account of Shaw's chippies, but he did not care to embarrass the man. The daylight shifted across the ceiling. Shaw was saying something about Blackwell.
"He's in the pubs up around Edgware Road today," he was muttering. "He thought it might be prudent to investigate the locals. Observed that the sack might have been carried on foot from a nearby location. It makes some sense. Of course, I don't imagine it would be easy to locate him. But if you're looking for something to do, you can keep him on the narrow for me."
William blinked, confused.
"Is Blackwell a drinker?"
"Mr. Blackwell? I should think not."
"Then I don't understand. He has his limits. You don't trust him to handle this. How many of your operatives do you trust?"
"All of them," William said. "None of them."
"Why put him in charge, then?"
"Mr. Blackwell's been useful in the past." Shaw pulled the napkin from his lap and dabbed at his mouth with impatience, then folded it twice into a clean triangle and set it on his plate and got to his feet. At the cloakroom, he took his coat from the attendant and shoved his arms through, but did not put on his hat, and he regarded William where he swayed.
"Did you ever get in touch with old Ben Porter?" he asked. "Did you ever ask him about Edward Shade?"
William gave him a quick, sharp look. He thought there must be something taunting in the man's question, but when he looked at Shaw, the chief's face was quiet, his expression earnest. William shook his head.
"Benjamin Porter died last year, John," he said. "Sally's gone, too."
Shaw paused.
"What? Dead?"
He banged his bowler softly against his belly as if to punch it taller, and then he set it low on his head.
"I'll be damned. Well, we didn't work together much, but I always did like him."
William did not know what to say to that. The attendant behind the polished counter of the cloakroom was studying with great intensity the ruff of a fur coat. The paneled oak walls seemed to pulse and draw back and lean inward. Then the attendant stepped forward and opened the door smoothly, and the air from the street felt startling in its clarity, like blown ice. William turned up the collar of his Chesterfield. There was a new brougham set low on its iron wheels at the edge of the pavement, and William glimpsed a young woman with blonde hair watching Shaw. The chief inspector nodded to her, then turned back, a reassuring hand on William's arm.
"I've an appointment I must take," he said. "Go find Blackwell. Get this all finished soon. The sooner you get out of my city, the better. You have a way of making a man look bad."
"I doubt that."
"You know my wife thinks you're a handsome devil. Said so at breakfast this morning."
"Well,
I tried to tell her what you were like, but she wouldn't hear it. I guess she's got her tastes."
He winked.
"But I've got my eye on you," he said. He stepped away. "Edgware Road," he called.
William raised a hand and smiled with the fever that was in him, and his smile felt gluey and hot and too bright in the grey chill of the streets. He watched Shaw glance furtively about, and then clamber up into the creaking brougham, and then a small gloved hand drew the curtain shut. The carriage swayed on its springs. The driver snapped the reins. The roar of the street took over. There were parts of him now, as he felt himself growing older, that would plunge vertically, like a mine shaft dug out of his life, into old fears and unresolved moments. Quarrels he had held with Margaret in their early years together. The silence in the house at the birth of their first daughter, Isabel. The impossible quiet as the walls creaked around him, and Margaret's screams fell abruptly away. And how he had stood with one hand on the fireplace mantel, and stared at his father across the room as the two of them waited. And then the thin thread of the newborn's cry, and the sudden fire blazing inside him. He did not know how much of this remembering was to do with the death of his father. He thought of Isabel, of the croup that had come so much to her, the savage coughing like a dog's bark, the heat of her skin, how he would walk with her the length of the house for hours at night, and how Margaret would look at him in the morning, her eyes red-rimmed and hazy. He remembered the dropper of ipecac, and the languid shift of his daughter's arms heavy at her sides, and the calomel powders in their small blue jars. How they had filled nightly the gutta percha bag his father had brought back from England with scalding water, and how they had laid this down in their daughter's crib in a desperate attempt to keep her temperature steady, while the snows came smoothly and whitely down over their world, tacking against the glass and melting and streaking the darkness beyond. He had never known such fear. And he remembered his own early years with his father, how his father would open an enormous Bible some place thick in the Old Testament, and the boy that he was would struggle to read the verses aloud. His father would sit forbiddingly beside him at the kitchen table, with his knuckles in his beard, like some ancient desert patriarch, while Robert cried in his crib, holding a gnarled, root-like finger under each word, and William would sound them slowly through, balanced crazily on the adult chair, his feet kicking in the air under the table. His father would explain nothing of the verses to him, and he learned not to ask. When he shut his eyes at night, he feared the Godhead would pour out from the dresser, an eerie mist enshrouding both father and son, and no part of it loving, only terrifying and wrathful. It was a warren of narrow lanes east of Edgware Road, ill-lit, filthy, its ash-brown bricks as old and air-pocked as any in London. He found Blackwell gingerly picking his way out of a tight alley on the edge of Portman Square, and he watched the inspector pause and withdraw a folded sheet of newspaper from his sleeve, and lean down with one hand on the wall and wipe at his shoes, then wipe at his fingers, one by one, then drop the crumpled newspaper to the ground. He had come upon him almost at once, and he could not believe the chance of it. He knew this corner of London had pubs the way Manhattan had jewelry rigs, and that he should have been hunting the man all day. "Your Mr. Shaw sent me," he said, coming up alongside him, his head throbbing. "I think he wants to keep me occupied. Any luck?" Blackwell was clutching a broadsheet, and William took it from him and unrolled it, and it was the drawing Breck had made. The face resembled Charlotte Reckitt around the eyes, perhaps, and in the severe set of the jaw. The inspector was looking at William with something like concern. "You should be a bed, sir," he said. "You look like death." "I'll sleep when I'm dead," William grunted. As they cut across Seymour Street and stood under the eaves of a papery shop, Blackwell told him which thoroughfares he had so far searched, which pubs he had entered, and there were bruises under the man's eyes. He had been on his feet since 4 o'clock that morning, and had learned, he said, nothing at all. At the corner of the next block, he showed a lad behind the spigots the drawing of Charlotte Reckitt, but the lad was either foreign or simple, and only gurgled some indecipherable reply. A woman with a wash rag over her shoulder peered at the picture and shrugged. There were a few sullen men drinking under the windows in the smeared light, but none had seen the woman either. They entered a small pub in the confines of Great Cumberland Street, and asked if there was a cellar on the premises, and the barman there laughed a toothless laugh and said, "Ha, and a carriage ass with oats and hive for when the Duke comes a-calling." The barman was 60 years old if a day, and one sleeve was pinned to his shoulder, and William studied his bleary eyes and said nothing. Blackwell showed the drawing. They turned east on Berkeley Street and north on Montague Street, and passed two pubs on either side of a haberdashery, but Blackwell explained neither would have a cellar. At the end of that block, they entered a corner pub and stepped down into a smoky darkness, and stood at the bar a long while before anyone came out to meet them. The girl who emerged from the back had a smudge of grime on her cheek and mouth, and she could not have been more than 10. William wondered what else they served beyond ale and food, but he did not ask. Blackwell showed the drawing, and she tucked a greasy strand of hair behind her ear, bit her lip, shrugged. She told them she weren't like to answer nothing except to paying customers. William bought a pint, and she drew it off with a practiced flick of the wrist, and carried it in her small hands, and he saw, when she set it on the counter, that she had to lift herself up onto the boards of her feet to do so. Blackwell showed her the drawing again. "Never seen her?"
"No, never."
So it went. On Gloucester Place, they walked up two flights of stairs and entered a rickety pub, grey and shabby in the lights of its big windows, and they asked two girls in gaudy shawls, who were eating beef stew with their fingers, but neither had seen the girl. On Upper Dorset Street they found a proprietor who thought he recognised the woman in the drawing. He asked them what they wanted her for, and Blackwell said it had to do with an inheritance, a distant relative who had passed. The man had thick, hairy forearms like a sailor, and dense white eyebrows, but was otherwise bald as a saddle. He thought he had seen her in a brothel off Drury Lane, and though Blackwell took note of this, William knew it would come to nothing. They crossed back down Byronston Square, and walked west on Upper George Street, and had no better luck. The weak daylight drained off. Their shadows melted in the dusk. By then it had been failing for an hour, and then it had been 2 hours, and then the streets had filled with men coming off shift, then emptied again, and by that time the pubs were lit and roaring. After a while William swore and stopped and looked grimly at Blackwell. "Well," he said, "I guess Charlotte Record is keeping her secret still." Blackwell nodded. "Whatever happened on that night, sir?" William stared down at him. "That is, whatever state of mind she was in, when last you saw her." "For God's sake! She jumped from Blackfriars Bridge, Inspector. What state do you imagine she was in?" Blackwell flushed. "Distraught, sir?" He turned away, discouraged. He had been watching the inspector all afternoon and thinking of Shaw's lack of faith in the man, and he wondered now, through the haze of his thoughts, what sort of enmity lay between them. He put a shaking hand to his chest, like a man twice his age, and felt his heart thumping rapid and shallow like the heart of a caged rodent. The day was done. Done, and they had nothing for it but a heat behind each heel that would blister up as soon as they took off their shoes. Charlotte Reckitt had vanished into the depths of the city and been carved up without a trace. "But there's always a trace," he told himself. "Almost always. You just want a bit of luck in the finding of it." His knee ached. He left Blackwell going through his little black notebook and went limping down to the corner to find a cab. But Charlotte Reckitt had not been distraught. Breathless, yes, from the run, but calm and assured under the gas lamps of the span, the crescent of her hair fuzzed in its glow. It was as if she had intended he run her down, as if she had desired it. He thought of Adam Fool's grief and felt a splinter worry away in his skull. He had known by nightfall that something must soon break. She had descended from her doorstep in Hampstead, looking left and then right, then walked south a half mile in the twilight to hail a passing hansom. William had watched her go with his hands plunged into his Chesterfield and his hat drawn low over his eyes. It had taken him some minutes to find a cab of his own, and he followed her to a theatre in St. Martin's Lane. The carriages and hansoms were jammed and moving slowly, and he paid and got down and walked ahead. He watched from under a closed shop front facing the theatre as the gaslights blazed and blazed, as the audience arrived in their finery and drifted, laughing up the wide steps. A beggar shuffled near, crooning, shuffled away. The carved doors had been propped wide with chains hooked to their frames. He watched the arrivals in their hooped gowns and sleek silk hats mill and laugh and make their way inside. At last Charlotte Reckitt had appeared in the window of her cab, and he waited for her to step down, and when she had gone in, he started across. In the lobby, he waited with some muttered excuse to the ushers as the doors closed and the house lights dimmed, and he could hear through the walls a muffled viola begin in a mournful key. She had come out before the first intermission. She did not see him. She collected her beaver fur from the cloakroom and moved swiftly toward the front doors, and it was then he had stepped out, taken her elbow in a fierce grip, and said, "But Miss LaRouche, the performance is only just beginning." She had recoiled, glared at him, and started angrily to protest. "Hush!" he said. An usher lounging behind the ticket counter with a pipe in his mouth had quickly stuffed it into one pocket, straightened his cap, regarded them with a ferret-eyed suspicion as William steered past.
"You are mistaken," she was whispering to him. "You have the wrong person."
And all at once he had grown tired of it. "Miss Reckitt," he had said, twisting her to face him at the top of the steps outside.
I'm not interested in whatever you might have done. That's not what I'm here for.
She had said nothing for a long moment, studying him with her dark eyes. The night air was cold. There were hansoms lined up at the cab stand down the street, the horses dipping into feed bags, the drivers with their legs crossed on their high seats, whips low.
I'm interested in you, he added.
In me, Mr. Pinkerton? Or in Edward Shade?
He let her go, all at once uneasy.
Come, sir. Don't look so surprised.
You have made no secret of it. She drew on her long gloves, held her coat out to William. After a moment, he took it from her, held it up, and she slipped her arms in and turned around.
Do you think to frighten me?
She had said, suddenly coy.
By stalking me at my home? By following me on my outings? You should know me better.
The usher was walking slowly across the lobby carpet towards them. He said,
What I know is a man like me isn't good for business. I know the sooner we talk, the sooner I leave you alone.
The stippled light over her face, the tiny white hairs along her upper lip.
This game we are playing, she had said softly, it has been amusing, sir. I shall enjoy playing it a while longer.
And she stepped gently forward against him. Her coat was open and he felt the heat of her breasts against his side, and then she slipped her wrists into his enormous hands, and William watched in confusion as her face twisted into an expression of absolute terror.
Help! She screamed. Help! Assault!
William shoved her backward, cursing. But already the usher was running towards them, and a second man from the street had turned in shock and started up the steps of the theater, and William felt his muscles tense, and he set his feet wide and his fists low.
Here, you now,
the usher was calling. He glanced helplessly as Charlotte Reckitt fluttered down the steps, her skirts billowing. Then the two men were upon him, and he held the one at arm's length as the other knocked his hat from his head and seized the collar of his coat. William hurled the usher backward, and wrestled the second man against the iron railing, and he struck him hard in the mouth, and the man slid sideways and fell to his knees. And then William was taking the steps two at a time, and running into the fog after Charlotte. She had turned onto the Strand, filled as it was with traffic, and he did not see her, and then he saw her in a hansom some 50 feet away. He seized the first cab he saw, and climbed aboard, and followed her through the press of carts and carriages, and when she jumped down at Ludgate Circus, he jumped down also and followed her down Bridge Street. She moved quickly despite her gown, and he was breathing hard when he reached Blackfriars Bridge, but she was only 20 feet from him by then, and he could see, yes, that he would catch her on the span, and there would be nowhere for her to go. 20. In the second week of October 1861, Edward Shade was officially mustered into the Flushing Battery of the 34th New York Light Artillery. He was handed a slip of government paper with the advance on his bounty amounting to $40, inscribed in purple ink, and he glanced up as the man next to him, with a scarred face and unshaven throat, carefully folded his own bounty into his shirt front, and then he, 3 months shy of his 14th birthday, did the same. He had no belongings but an old bent hat 2 sizes too large, and a pair of good leather shoes, and he found himself in a long wooden bunkhouse, filled with the indigent and idealistic both, every man but he untying bundled sleep sacks and spare boots and long underwear. None of those goods would reach the battlefront when it came. All this was at a training camp on Long Island, the rain plunging through the winter dark, until the fields fairly drummed with it, and the men waded through the cold, clear waters muttering about having enlisted in the Navy. Flushing Battery's captain was a fussy German by the name of Roma, who struggled to pronounce his W's, and whose voice, excited, would scramble to a shrill pitch. Roma's eyes were very blue and his rough hair very red, and his left eye slid inward, giving him a sinister visage. He had learned his shoemaker's trade in Stuttgart before emigrating in 1839, and he had still the sharp, waxed beard and mocking eyebrows of his trade. He was much hated. Roma rewarded tidiness, promptness, boots kept in polish despite any weather, and punished severely any minor infraction. Private Shade, tidy, prompt, polished, found himself praised and soon promoted, never mind that as battery corporal he stood three-quarters the height of the next youngest recruit. Roma did not care. He wanted glory and death. He drilled them in the rain with a tireless ferocity, their field guns wedged on tremendous wheels, positioned, aimed, unlocked and dragged again through deep mud, the gun crews mucking their loads of hollow shells across the fields and back, until it was too dark to see, and the languishing men had lost their boots in the mud, and Roma himself had vanished into a thin orange outline of lantern shine and blown rain. Edward slept a godforsaken sleep each night, and woke early and stirred his bunk crews to attention in the gloom, knowing Roma would soon stomp through. Roma in full regimentals, Roma impatient to spread his misery. All the same, it was gentler than orphaned street life. The world of his father's cutters, the world of Shade House and its vast, elegant rooms, all of that had been obliterated long ago by the scrabble and grime and soft core of hunger that had been life in the gutters. When an ex-printer, with black-rimmed nails and thick forearms, pushed him aside for the second time and scooped up his food, Edward met the man's eye and then walked out of the mess tent. That night, when the bastard went to the privies, Edward followed, carrying an iron pipe as long as his arm. He called to the man by name to turn him, and then struck him sharply across one ear. And when his hands went up, Edward struck him twice in the groin with the pipe, and the man's bowels erupted. He crushed a rib on either side of the man's barreled chest, and when he was finished, he threw the iron pipe into the open trench of the latrine. "Come after me again, and I'll kill you," he said flatly. The man never did. At the end of October, Roma promoted him to sergeant in charge of his own cannon, with a crew of five, and on the 13th of November, Flushing Battery was ordered south to Camp Barry in Washington. One week later, in a freezing rain, the entire battery, pale, dispirited, was shipped by cattle car to reinforce General Milroy at Camp Cheat Mountain in West Virginia. By the 1st of December, they were peering grimly across the Staunton Turnpike at the white drifts of smoke from the Confederate camp on the facing mountain. Roma brooded, paced, brooded, staring out into the dusk and the sheer drop with madness in his eye. The days passed. Occasionally they would fix their range and fire shot and shell for hours on end, and the older Confederate guns would reply, but there was in such probings a tired, depressed air. Then on the 13th of December came the bloody storming of Allegheny Mountain. Edward was struck in the knee, and again in the thigh, while loading a cannon in the freezing wind, and carried away from the guns screaming. He had not ever known such pain. As no arteries had been hit, he lay shivering in the hospital at Green Spring Run near Cheat Mountain for several days with little attention. They had cut two balls from his leg, and a third had passed clean through. 19 others from his regiment had been wounded that day, and 3 horses killed, and the confusion and stink of flesh was overwhelming. On the second morning in the field tent, a nurse leaned over the next cot and spoke to the dying boy, writhing there, calling him Sergeant Shade. And Edward had raised his own weak head at that, meaning to speak up. But something held his tongue. The boy's lower jaw had been shot away, and his face and chest heavily bandaged, and no one could have known him by sight. Someone had confused the paperwork at the cots. A priest came that afternoon and sat on an overturned crate with his Bible open on one knee, and addressed the boy as Sergeant Shade, out of New York, and Edward lay listening to the prayer with his eyes on the ceiling, where the shadows crawled like flies, and shortly thereafter, the false Shade died. All that night he lay awake, thinking. In the morning, a new snow had fallen and covered the yard and the crates and the flatbed wagons in silence. The sentry was asleep. He lifted his head and stared out through the open tent flap at an impossible whiteness, and he climbed out of his cot and buttoned his coat with shaking fingers, and vanished back into the civilian world, a ghost. Fool studied his face in the pier glass, cracks at the corners of his eyes, the skin sallow and bruised. his aged eyebrows, his nose raw in the cold, the heavy grooves lining his mouth. Somehow the light in his eyes had failed him. He stood in his baggy nightshirt, feeling a cold seep through his stockings, and thinking of Pinkerton, the mudlark, the tunnels. They had emerged exhausted and shivering into Leicester Square and parted ways with a silent handshake. They would meet again in 2 nights' time at a public house on the edge of Shadwell, and proceed in search of the Lascar's opium den, and there had been, in the big man as he walked away, some slow, assured sadness that Fool had noticed and weighed. He drifted across the room to the small writing desk under the window and sat, the folds of his nightshirt blooming around him. The curtain stood cracked, and he could see the grey winter sunlight in the windows of the terraced house opposite. A widow lived there, he knew, a lonely woman who used to find any excuse to exit her house whenever Fool exited his. The follies of the grieving. Before going into the sewers, Pinkerton had interviewed Martin Reckitt and discussed him, Fool. He did not believe it any real risk. No one but Flood knew the truth of Edward Shade. He tried to imagine Reckitt sitting across from a man like William Pinkerton and betraying the confidences of the Flash world, and he could not do it. But then the Reckitt he had known hadn't yet been 10 years in the Tench. What he wanted was some clarity. After a moment, he withdrew a sheet of writing paper from a cubby and dipped a pen into a jar of ink, and began to forge a letter of introduction from Mr. Gabriel Utterson, solicitor, to the wardens of Millbank Penitentiary. Sometimes the only way to get, he thought, is by going. In the mid-morning chill, he walked through the crowds of the Mall with the falsified letter in a satchel, and cut through St. James's Park, and made his way down to the brown flats of the river, the low wall of the embankment blue in the frost. He went alone and told no one of his going. When he looked out, he could see the Albert Embankment across the river, and the silhouettes of lampposts with arms upraised like crucified thieves. He crossed the frosted setts at an awkward slide. After Brindisi, he had sworn off revenge, but some part of him still burned at a low boil, and something else, some reluctant thing in his heart, made him understand visiting Reckitt now was the closest he would come to seeing Charlotte again in the quick. Was it a farewell, he sought? Was it some kind of leave-taking? A settling of accounts? For 10 years he had kept himself from the Reckitts, their old haunts, their old accomplices, struggling to forget South Africa. The old thief would think his coming now a weakness, he knew, as perhaps it was. At Millbank he presented his falsified letter with its seal to the gatekeeper, and stood with his hands clasped in the small of his back, waiting while the massive gates were lifted from their anchors and drawn back.
"I never seen you here afore," the gatekeeper muttered, opening the visitor's book in the gatehouse.
Fool blew on his cold fingers. He was dressed like a junior solicitor and carried a card to that effect, and he frowned importantly. The visitor's hall was in a central wing on the lower tier, a long narrow room with spider-cracked walls and plaster peeling overhead, and a row of dusty tables under windows. Fool shivered as he waited. Through the far door he saw a guard escort a grey, withered man in brown prison-issue clothes. His wrists and ankles were shackled, and he walked with a pained, shuffling gait, and it took Fool a moment to recognize his old accomplice. His chains were unlocked, and drawn clanking through an iron anchor set into the wall beneath the table, and then relocked, and then the guard walked bored back to the far door. Reckitt glanced balefully behind him, as if longing to be returned to his cell. Millbank had roughened him. He looked so much thinner, almost transparent, like a sheet of tissue paper held to a flame. Fool tried to see in the creature, seated before him, the confidence man of Port Elizabeth, that old elegance, but he could not do so. His fingers swollen, the nails cracked, a blue web of veins visible in his cheeks, his forehead. When he closed his eyelids, he looked almost another man, leaning his face back into the shaft of sunlight coming in through the high window.
"So Adam Fool has come to Millbank," Reckitt said, his voice creaking.
He opened his eyes and met Fool's stare, and his own eyes were clear, pale, calm.
"It is true, then, he said, about Charlotte. Fool cleared his throat. You would not be here if it weren't, Reckitt said. His eyes hardened. I have been reminding myself that we are all here by the grace of the Lord, that his purpose is kindness.
Kindness, Fool muttered. He felt already unbalanced. He remembered uneasily this man's talent for seizing and twisting a conversation.
What I did not expect, Reckitt said, is how difficult the fact of it would be to accept. I understand it is true. Charlotte is dead. But I do not believe it. I do not believe it because what happens in the outside does not happen in here.
Fool was silent. The grey light fell in squares across the far wall.
We are born dying, Reckitt murmured. Tell me, who would design it so? Why would the good Lord give us a body which must suffer?
Reckitt paused. Unless he is not the good Lord after all. Unless goodness is not his concern. If I wanted to talk faith, I'd go to a priest. A real one.
There are no real priests. Reckitt studied his ravaged hands. You think I sound mad. I do not care. A man can stare at a thing for years and not see it for what it is.
Fool shook his head. I came to tell you I mean to find him, he said. Charlotte's killer. I mean to make him suffer.
That is not why you came. What are you doing back in London?
Charlotte wrote me.
Charlotte.
Fool nodded, watching the thief's sudden stillness. What she was working on, he said. She wanted to bring me into it. Reckitt lowered his face, and now Fool saw undisguised that plunging darkness he had once feared years ago, a vortex inside the man's heart, vicious and without end.
You are a liar, Adam Fool, Reckitt said softly.
An ugly satisfaction rose in Fool, rose and was gone, leaving only a heaviness in its place. He was surprised by his own meanness, despite their common grief, and all at once he wanted to get the meeting over with. William Pinkerton came to see you, he said.
Reckitt tilted his head to one side, as if he had not heard.
William Pinkerton came to see you, and you spoke with him?
I imagined shame would have kept you from coming here, Reckitt murmured. Do you know how the church defines shame?
What did you tell Pinkerton, Martin? What did he ask?
Reckitt removed his hands from the table and settled them in his lap, the chains clinking. He studied Fool. The nature of the devil, he said quietly. That is what we discussed. Evil.
Evil.
Among other matters, yes.
I was one of those other matters.
Reckitt gave him a long, hooded look. I see I am not the only one Mr. Pinkerton has visited, he said. Do you know what the devil is, Adam? He is our own deceit. Our own deceit made flesh. We make him by being what we are.
Pinkerton is not the devil, Martin.
Not Pinkerton.
Fool wondered if some mania had devoured the man after his long years alone in Millbank. You saved my life once, he murmured. Then you took what was mine by rights and left me in Brindisi to die. If you had...
I did not save your life, Adam.
Fool blinked.
I did not save your life. I spared it.
Reckitt's reptilian eyes held his own in a hard, bright stare.
I have often asked myself, would I know the truth if I met it? If I stood before it, would the truth know me?
The ancient thief leaned in closer. He lowered his voice.
Charlotte never came to you in Brindisi as she was supposed to, Adam. Why? All those years ago, when she came back from Port Elizabeth, when I came to you in Brindisi, I spared your life. Why?
Something went through, Fool, then. Some presentiment of dread, a lightness in his skull. He could hear a machinery working deep in the blood box of his ears.
Why?
He said. The old man gave him a disgusted look.
Because she was with child.
With child? Reckitt raised his fists over his head and shook his chains for the guard. The clatter was harsh in the quiet room.
Fool watched the figure detach from the wall, drift lazily towards them.
"You're lying," Reckitt shrugged. "Charlotte never had a child. You're lying."
"All right.
Prove it. Where's this child now?"
The old thief looked at Fool, and Fool saw then all of the loneliness and brutality that was in himself also. The guard shambled nearer. Reckitt leaned in close. Fool could smell the sour milk smell of his skin.
"It died," he said.
In better years, the crates that arrived at the Emporium arrived sometimes weather-worn, the grey wood shrunken from salt water, jungle rainfall, the sudden cold of the English weather, and Fool would brace an ear against the first plank, and with a crowbar begin to twist and pry back the warped nails in their beds. He had such a feeling inside his chest as he came out of the penitentiary. The sky was brown, the light in the faces he passed white and eerie. At a busy corner he waited for an omnibus, and when it rained to a stop it was already packed. He clung to the roof seats as the nails in his heart creaked and bent slowly back. He did not believe Reckitt's lie. He was not so foolish as that. He got off the omnibus in a black mood, vicious with himself for having met with the man. Already the day had deepened, though it was only just noon, the cold crackling its way across the slate roofs of the city. He was walking fast to keep his body distracted. Past a papery shop, writing implements and leather notebooks fanned out in its windows. Past a tailor's, a dry goods emporium, and on. He could not say what he had expected from Millbank, but if he was honest with himself, it was something to do with forgiveness and grief. His throat began to ache, the warped nails prying loose. He slowed to a walk, and then he stopped, a still figure in the center of the footpath, while the city flowed on around him and under him and past.
"Mr. Fool,"
a voice said at his elbow. He glanced up and saw a florid face, a throat wrapped and double-wrapped in a scarf. It was Gabriel Utterson. The unlikeliness of it left him staring in confusion, and he raised his eyes and saw across the street the arched entrance to Utterson's court offices, and he saw the solicitor's leather satchel tucked up under an elbow, as if he was on pressing business, and Fool did not understand how he had walked so far.
"Gabriel," he said thickly, "I'm just stepping out, sir. Is it pressing?"
Then Utterson paused, peered into his face with a cold, assessing eye.
"You are looking for me, sir?"
He was startled to feel the man's grip at his elbow, to feel himself guided to one side.
"No matter,"
the solicitor murmured. "I am pleased to have found you. I had intended to seek you out." Fool buttoned the uppermost eyelet of his coat and turned up his collar. He wanted only to be alone.
"I've been thinking of what we discussed,"
the solicitor said.
"Rose has been much distressed. About Charlotte, I mean."
He shifted his bulk, grasped Fool's arm again.
"Rose believes she has found a contact for you, but it is complicated. There are conditions to be met."
Fool did not immediately reply. Seeing in his mind's eye a blood-soaked bed, stained sheets bundled by candlelight, hearing the long, low, keening wail.
"I've offended you," Utterson said. "It was kindly meant, sir."
"You haven't."
Fool held up a tired hand.
"You haven't, Gabriel."
The solicitor's left eye twitched under its lid.
"Rose says there has been talk on the other side. She is willing to try to reach your Charlotte. The circle can be closed Tuesday next, sir, if the signs remain favourable. But success is not certain. I am told the attempt would be much magnified if you were to bring with you a particular companion."
"How particular?"
"Not your Mr. Flood. He would tear the room apart looking for conspirators. No, Rose has someone else in mind. A great advantage to reaching Charlotte would be if someone who was with her near her end were to sit with us, one of the last to see her alive."
Something flickered in Utterson's eyes, a quick, sleek menace, and was gone. Fool did not at first take the man's meaning, and then he did.
"Pinkerton?"
"Indeed."
"That's madness, Gabriel. That's inviting the devil to dine."
Utterson folded his chin into the scarf at his throat.
"We would need to be cautious, yes."
The
The man will start a file on all of us.
I rather expect he has already started on you.
Fool paused, his breath clouding in the cold.
I won't ask Pinkerton, Gabriel.
Are you so protective of him?
I won't see the man provoked.
Nor should you.
Utterson's eyes were sharp.
I hear stories, Mr. Fool. Stories I can scarcely credit. Midnight excursions among the mudlarks of Blackfriars, for instance. I was sure they were mistaken, that you would not keep such company as William Pinkerton.
Company you would share.
To facilitate the seance, sir. Only that.
The two men stood under the cold archway while crowds of law clerks crashed past, and the horse-drawn omnibuses rattled by in the loud street. Fool thought of Charlotte sitting convalescent at an afternoon window, watching sunlight play across a turned-over garden, and he imagined a silence inside her. He refused to concede his private business to a man such as this.
Adam,
Utterson was murmuring, you know my sister's integrity. She makes no assurance of contact. It is not a deceit. Sometimes the worlds come together as we would wish. Sometimes they do not. Rose can only promise she is willing to try. High overhead, the stone buildings loomed, canescent and sinister.
If one opens their ears, it is a beautiful message, sir,
Utterson was murmuring. Beautiful, and yet so few wish to hear it.
How stubborn we are, how easily frightened.
Fool could glimpse a melancholy in his voice like light through the cracks in a floor, though it was a light he could not stand on, and a floor that would hold no weight. Grief was selfish. Grief was angry. He would damn any who would take it from him. He knew this the way he knew he was right-handed, and that a scar cut like a question mark deep into his cheek under his whiskers. Grief was a part of him, a part of how he had lived, what he had been made from.
I will sit with her, he said, but I make no promises about Pinkerton.
He was a dead man when he left the field hospital outside Cheat Mountain, and already buried in a soldier's grave when he fled north into Ohio. The war had drained the country even then, and he walked in ruined shoes through deep snow, feeling the wind biting at his neck, and seeing no sign of life. Wagons standing unhitched in the road, farmhouses with doors standing open and snowdrifts blown inside. Christmas morning found him asleep in a barn, rolled in straw, and the animals long since gone. When the year turned a week later, he was huddled under a railroad bridge in West Pennsylvania, with two other deserters, none trusting the others, while a low fire burned in a rusted barrel. He was by that time wearing women's gloves with the fingers cut out, and a farmhand's woolens and boots that reached halfway to his thighs. The men huddled with him looked old and savage, but they gave him his space, and he wondered for the first time how he himself must look. When he broke the ice to clean his face the next morning, he saw hollow eyes, a gaunt stare, the haunted face of a grown man. All night, trains rattled past overhead, snow sifting through the ties all around them in the darkness, dreamlike and sad. By the 10th of January, he had caught a boxcar in the freezing wind and ridden across the state to New York, starving, feeling a lightness burn up out of his legs and hands. He did not know what he was. He was not exactly a deserter, but nor was he a free man. He would think sometimes of his old captain, wondering if he had found the death he had sought. Fool tried his hand at pickpocketing in the railroad stations, but he was too weak and miserable-looking and could not get near his marks. He knew legally that Sergeant Shade had died, and so at last he gave up and enlisted again under a new name, in a regiment out of Rikers Island. Once more he pocketed the $40 advance on his bounty, and shortly afterwards he leaned his rifle against a rough barricade in the frozen mud pits around the unfinished Capitol and fled from his picket into the night. A door had opened. He had glimpsed a new kind of war. In February he made his way north to Boston. He enlisted under a third name in exchange for a further $40. This bounty he accepted like a boy just in from farm country, like a boy dazzled by the sight of it. He had burned through that first bounty in dice games with the other recruits, but now he had it in mind to set something aside for a venture after the war. He jumped again,
and re-enlisted back in New York the following week, feeling a kind of eerie shadow at his back. And here, his luck failed him at last. The parade ground was clear of snow, but hard-packed and cracking from the frost, when he heard a familiar voice call out, "Sergeant?" And when he glanced lazily back, he found himself staring up into the crossed blue eyes of Captain Roma.
"Sergeant's shade," Roma said.
He was leaning on a crutch, his left trouser leg folded back and pinned at the knee. His sharp teeth smiled in disbelief.
"You're mistaken, sir,"
Fool said, and walked calmly away. But that night, two soldiers came for him in his bunk and hauled him, half-dressed, into the cold and beat him severely. He was handcuffed, interrogated, beaten again. It was the end of March by then. He was held in a stockade in that northern military camp for several weeks with two other deserters, and there was a desperation and a fear etched in each face, for they knew what lay ahead. Roma had come limping into the stockade one day with a quiet triumph, and explained to the guard that the three prisoners were to be shipped south to the Army of the Potomac as deserters and cowards. There would be no court-martial. In the capital, they would be held until the army mobilized and sailed for the James River. When the battles began, the deserters would be shackled in irons and shoved stumbling into the front lines without weapons and forced at gunpoint to run at the Confederate positions.
"Be ground up like meat, them three," one of the guards, a Texan, grinned.
"But I expect the boy won't be much troubled by it,"
Roma said, eyeing Fool, shivering through the bars.
"Why's that?"
"Because he's already dead," Roma said. "Isn't that right, Sergeant? Aren't you already dead?"
Leering and dragging the swaddled elbow of his crutch across the bars as he spoke. 21. The scarred, vicious face of Muck Annie haunted William in the days following. He had left Fool at the sewer entrance two nights earlier, on the understanding that they would meet again, this night, at a public house on the edge of Shadwell. He had stooped in under the crooked timber doorframe and peered about at the dejected in their cups, feeling a sudden uneasiness, and then turned and gone back out. But 10 minutes later, Fool had approached, whistling softly under his breath, and together they started down into the crowded East End. The streets were lit only by old-fashioned lanterns creaking from hooks that had been nailed into the lintels of public houses in the murderous days of George III, and there were no lights else but for the flare and sheen reflecting off the puddles and rivers of muck in the streets. St. George's Street. Whatever else, it was not England. Bearded Jews with their ringlets and prayer shawls wading powerfully through the crowds like some ancient warning from the east, their shoulders wide set, their necks bullish, walking 5 abreast and wringing empty sacks in their fists. Peddlers with stacks of stained silk hats tottering on their lice-ridden heads, tiny pickpockets running barefoot through the sludge. Once the crowds parted like a sea, and out of the throng William saw emerge a very short Turk in a tall white headdress, and in his fist was a rope, and at the end of that rope a brindled cow. Drunk Swedes, with faces painted like acrobats, shouted out some mournful song over the heads of the crowd, laughing at their own misery as if it were some joke. Pigs ran loose underfoot. At the corner of Cannon Street Road, William met the dark Asiatic stare of a woman selling Bibles from an overturned crate, and he looked quickly past her. Just beyond, like a pale horror rising from the blackness, the limestone tower of St. George in the east. Fool mingled. Fool did not slow. The air was cold. They passed two ladies in fur collars leading a monkey on a leash north towards Shadwell Station, and William looked at it and understood it would be dead within the week. They walked downwind from Jamrach's menagerie, the reek of offal and shit and animal fear shouldering past them. They passed the walled rose garden of the old Wesleyan graves. At a pie stand, he saw a thin man wrapped in rags exhibiting a bucket of turtles to a gaggle of urchins, cloth caps folded into little fists, eyes agog. The man swung the turtles in an elegant dance, and he saw the man's milky stare, and he knew that the wretch was blind. Then they